and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakura, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
We think the minister made other legal errors. He didn't know with any precision what gas would be put into this facility if it's extended out to 2070. Because
the Australian Conservation Foundation takes legal action against a major Northwest Shelf gas project.
Our systems, our structures are probably not adequate enough to respond swiftly and quickly to those far-right movements and activities that they undertake, but also at the same time support communities to thrive.
Victorian Multicultural Review urges policies to improve social cohesion and inclusion. And later today...
Not being able to easily afford or physically access digital technologies or feel really confident in using them in part of your everyday life means that people are feeling increasingly disconnected.
New study shows nearly 6 million Australians face digital exclusion. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. The Australian Conservation Foundation is challenging the Northwest Shelf approval in the federal court. The reasons for this challenge, according to the ACF, are the Minister for Environmental, Murray Watt, has failed to consider the physical effects of climate change as an impact, and the approval has left out critical details. The Wire's contributor from Tune FM's Ash Taylor spoke with Australian Conservation Foundation's General Counsel Adam Beeson.
Environment Minister Murray Watt in September approved an extension for the Northwest Shelf Gas Project until 2070. This week, the Australian Conservation Foundation has announced their intention to challenge this approval in the federal court, arguing that the minister failed to consider the impacts of climate change and left out critical details in the approval.
The Australian Conservation Foundation, as you said, Ash, is challenging the federal Environment Minister Murray Watt's decision to approve Woodside's Northwest Shelf extension. This gas project has been approved to operate out until the end of 2070. And it's set to unleash an estimated 4 billion tonnes of climate pollution. And just to put that into context for your listeners, that's around 10 years of what Australians as an entire population will emit in climate pollution. So this is an enormously polluting project. And ACF has been campaigning to stop this extension out to 2070 for many years. This legal challenge is focused on mistakes that we say the minister made in applying the national environmental law. Specifically, the minister decided that the climate change consequences of this project were not relevant to his decision making, and we think he's got that wrong. Now, if we're successful in that part of our case, that could reshape the way climate impact is assessed in Australia. We think the minister made other legal errors. He didn't know with any precision what gas would be put into this facility if it's extended out to 2070, because part of the approval is to allow for third-party gas, that is companies other than Woodside, to process their gas at this facility. And the final legal error we think the minister made was he leant on the scale when it came to the economic assessment, which is part of his decision-making. And he did that by factoring in an unapproved and really controversial new gas basin project called Browse, the Browse Basin, which is under Scott Reef. And Scott Reef is one of the most pristine marine environments in the world. So those are the three reasons we think the minister made a mistake, but ultimately it will now be up to the court to decide.
So, Adam, my understanding is that when it comes to evaluating the climate impact, there actually isn't a legal requirement under the law to consider that. So is that an issue with the law, or is that an issue with the minister's decision?
ACF will be telling the court that it is a legal requirement to consider the climate impacts. The difficulty we have with the current law is it's not specific to climate. That is, climate change is not mentioned in our national environmental law in terms of what needs to be considered in approval decisions. Now, our argument is that that doesn't mean it can be ignored, and we think we've got a good case there. However, the best solution in the longer term would be for the government to, as part of the reform process that is underway, to make it absolutely crystal clear and to set out the correct processes that proponents need to go through to ensure that the climate consequences of their projects are properly assessed by the Environment Minister. It would be a huge failure of this government in this reform process if they fail to address climate change.
How do you hope these proceedings will inform future environment laws and conservation efforts?
Well, we hope that the court will accept our argument that environment ministers can't simply ignore the consequences on our climate when it comes to these heavy emitting projects, particularly fossil fuel projects. So we hope to set that legal precedent. And as I said, it also is an example of how important it is that the National Environmental Law is reformed to make clear for developers and the community how the impacts of climate change are factored into decision making.
Do you have an estimate of how long these proceedings will go for? When will a decision be reached?
It's very early days. The proceedings have just commenced. We expect there'll be a timetable developed in the next month or so. It's difficult to predict court cases, but based on our experience, we'd expect the case to unfold over the next 3 to 6 months.
And just finally, is there anything that you'd like to add now, just before we finish?
Many Australians were shocked and outraged by the Minister's decision to approve Woodside's Northwest Shelf gas extension. And ACF is bringing these legal proceedings. It's not an easy step to take. Litigation never is, and we haven't done it lightly. But Australians are already in the firing line for climate fuel disasters. Australian communities are struggling with heat waves, fires and floods. And ACF just won't stand by while the minister makes what we think is a wrong decision when applying laws that are supposed to protect Australians and our precious environment.
Minister for the Environment Murray Watt says his decision was made in accordance with the law, saying, "The conditions I set, along with those set by the Western Australian government, were designed to prevent significant damage to the rock art, which is the test required under the EPBC Act." The minister declined to comment further on the matter due to the legal proceedings.
Tune FM's Ash Taylor with the story. The Victorian Multicultural Review was launched at the end of September, revealing the state of social cohesion in Victoria. The review is recommending moving towards a more inclusive community, tackling systematic issues such as discrimination, building capacity for multicultural organisations, and that the government should implement more policies towards social cohesion. Channel 31's contributor Lakshmi Ganapathy started asking chairperson of the Victorian Multicultural Commission, Vivian Nguyen AM, to describe how the social cohesion in the state is at this point.
There's no doubt that the last couple of years has been very challenging for the multicultural and faith communities. And as much as everybody tried, I think it is a good time to have a look at our tools, our structures and our systems, and to do a stock take of whether or not they are still appropriate for our time. So I welcome that review, and I think it's a good time to reflect on the past and look at the current challenges that we face and how we can really continue to strengthen harmony and cohesion and ensure that Victoria remains a welcoming place for everybody.
So I put this question to the Race Discrimination Commissioner, but I would also like to ask you, social cohesion has obviously been strained by the recent protests. Do you believe that we are responding adequately to the threat of the far right?
Let me just say that the Victorian Multicultural Commission condemns rallies such as that. We believe that neo-Nazis have no place in civic or public life. And we denounce that March for Australia rally. Our systems, our structures are probably not adequate enough to respond swiftly and quickly to those far-right movements and activities that they undertake, but also at the same time support communities to thrive. and to ensure that multiculturalism is good for Australia and is good for Victoria.
Absolutely. And equally, this recent protest revealed the extent of views in our community. So how do we go about enhancing social cohesion with the knowledge that these views exist in our community?
Some of the important aspects of the work that the Victorian Multicultural Commission does is to engage and to listen and to collaborate with communities. I think to enable us to feel, to strengthen social cohesion, to strengthen the contributions of multicultural and faith in everybody, I think it's really important that we create and capture those opportunities for people to understand more, to appreciate one another's perspective, to have to give each other that due respect, and to agree on ways forward that supports and benefits people from Victoria and from this country. And that, I think, is a lot of that comes through from the Multicultural Review, and that is why the Victorian Multicultural Commission supports it.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of the review, I did want to move on to some questions about it. Yeah. And the most significant recommendation is discontinuing the Victorian Multicultural Commission in favour of a new organisation, Multicultural Victoria. How will Multicultural Victoria be better placed to deal with the current challenges?
I think it is important to recognise that over the 40 years that the VMC has been established since 1983 on what was called Ethnic Affairs Commission to what it is today, the Commission has always played a very important role in connecting, engaging and listening and collaborating with communities. This new structure, moving from the combination of the department and the commission, will enable it, as we understand it from the report, will enable the commission to continue with that level of independence, that level of additional resources, but importantly, keeping that engagement with the communities. The report is titled Trust, or Rebuilding Trust. We can't have trust without relationship, and we cannot have trust without genuine engagement and understanding and support towards some common goals. And that's why I think the new structure will help support that.
And another major recommendation made is a social cohesion commitment, which means that those applying for funding need to demonstrate that they value social cohesion. How would something like that be enforced to empower applicants rather than restrict them?
That is an area, I think, that will require some further conversations and discussion around the specificities of how you pledge to adhere to certain rules, particularly when it also covers your employees, your contractors, and your volunteers. And we know that in communities, most of these organisations are run by volunteers. And so the level of understanding does differ from one organisation to another, from one group to another. So that's why I believe that capacity building funding that is also announced at the same time as a review will play a very critical role in making sure organisations and members of the communities are able to understand what it is that they sign up to and why, and are equipped to be able to adhere to those values.
Vivian Nguyen from the Victorian Multicultural Commission there, speaking with Channel 31's Lakshmi Ganapathy. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. A group of Monash University students are demanding action from the Australian government over the ongoing detention of an Australian man in Saudi Arabia. Dr. Osama Al-Hassani was arrested in 2021 by Saudi authorities over allegations of car theft committed in 2015. But Human Rights Watch and his legal team argue that his detention was politically motivated. With limited government intervention to date, Monash students have launched a petition calling for his immediate release and protection of academic freedom worldwide. The Wire's Sarah Jensen spoke with Madeline Collins about the campaign.
Our work is primarily, firstly, to raise awareness of academic freedom and the threats that it is facing globally currently. And then secondly, about the unjust conviction of Dr. Osama al-Hassani and campaigning for his release from prison. We did get a response from the Saudi Arabian delegate in Australia, and he responded to our email saying that currently he is alive and safe. But based upon his court case, he should have been released after 4 years, but it's been more than that. And 2021 was when he should have been released, but he hasn't.
In your opinion, do you think the Australian government has done enough since his detention?
No, and this is a really good question, Sarah, because essentially Australia, the Human Rights Watch has issued like high alert for Dr. Osama's case. Since 2021, there has been no live updates either from the Australian government or the Human Rights Watch or any other international bodies as to his whereabouts or his whether he's alive or been released. The Australian government does seem to want to take the political stance of not ruffling any feathers. So they don't want to get involved with countries that are perceived as being volatile in the sense of international politics. So they have not done enough. They haven't done anything. And we have reached out to the Human Rights Commissioner with a copy of our dossier and a call for her to endorse our advocacy campaign. We haven't heard anything as of yet. But, yeah, there's a clear omission of the government to act in any public way that is, yeah, around any incarcerated academics worldwide that are Australian citizens as well, I will add. He's an Australian citizen.
Beyond his individual case, Dr. Hassani's case, what broader concerns does this detention raise about academic freedom and scholars' safety?
I think this raises a really big question as to worldwide how we are becoming a much more conservative world, but it is actually placing a lot of barriers on academic freedom and academic integrity. Universities being controlled through funding, especially in America, means that the government can influence what is to be researched and what is to not be said. We've seen that historically that means that the government can place coercive controls on what is taught and therefore influencing the broader population. What it means for everyone worldwide is that there is a sharp curtailing of any academic individuality, and you are not allowed to have an opinion that is contrary to the power's opinion.
And what's the overall goal of your campaign? What kind of response are you hoping for?
We are hoping for a concrete evidence and response from the Saudi Arabian government to confirm Dr. al-Hassani's whereabouts and current health state, and also more evidence as to suggest when or if he has been released. Additionally, we just want to advocate and raise awareness for academic integrity and the fact that it is being threatened globally, and that this threat is actually something that is potentially going under the radar because it's occurring in back rooms and it's occurring through funding and coercive control via the government, as opposed to being something that's out in the open. But its impacts are actually far more widespread than most people would assume.
Monash University law student Madeline Collins there, speaking with The Wire's Sarah Jensens. Nearly 6 million Australians are being left behind by the country's rapid shift to digital technology, according to new research. Experts warn the digital inequality is deepening, with barriers like cost, access and digital skills cutting people off from essential services and social connection. I spoke with sociologist Dr. Ash Watson from the University of New South Wales, who says urgent action is needed to prevent further exclusion.
So much of our society now revolves around digital technologies. Tech is really baked into the fabric of our social life today. So not being able to easily afford or physically access digital technologies or feel really confident in using them in part of your everyday life means that people are feeling increasingly disconnected from others and unable to take advantage of a whole heap of normal things in their day-to-day life, from employment and banking to government services. Even social media is really significant in how people form and maintain relationships today. So not being able to benefit from those and confidently access them is really making people feel left out and left behind.
What are some ways people can feel more confident using technology?
So the research we've done has really been looking at all of the great things that are happening in people's local communities to help support people's digital inclusion. Public libraries are a really fantastic example of this. Libraries across the country are doing amazing, locally relevant programs that people can go along to for free to learn all sorts of things, from how to use a smartphone to how to better protect your personal information online, even new skills like generative AI. Public libraries are doing some really amazing free programs around these things. And librarians also offer personal support for a lot of people. If you have a technology issue or there's some information you'd like to help find, librarians are a great, great resource for people to be able to draw on.
I mean, technology is always evolving and it's always hard to keep up with it. How can we make sure people are not left behind? I know you mentioned the libraries are great resources, but is there any other resources?
There are three kind of key interlocking problems that we need to address. So the three main barriers to people feeling and being digitally included are cost, access, and ability. So we really need to make progress on all of these fronts. So cost is about the affordability of digital technologies and the internet. This is a really complicated problem because even though, say, an internet data package has become a bit more affordable over time for people to have good data provisions in their homes, many of us have personally experienced what's called digital obsolescence, or where new technologies are continually brought out and you need to buy the new one in order to stay up to date because they're no longer built to be easily repaired. So cost is a really tricky one, and we need to be able to have more access for people to not just be left behind when they can't afford to buy a new device that they need. Mm-hmm. Access spans a lot of different things, from physical access, so addressing things like internet black spots, which predominantly affects people in rural remote areas, but also is a big problem for people living in urban and city areas as well. But access is also about physical accessibility. So a lot of digital technologies are designed for people who are able-bodied and young and kind of really confident in a digital environment, rather than for people who might have a whole host of physical accessibility challenges with digital technologies, like their eyesight or physical touch. So access is a really complicated one as well, and there's a whole heap of things that we can do about how devices are designed, but also how the internet is provided across the country.
You talk about shifting from a technology first to a people first mindset. What do you mean by that, and how can we make that move?
One of the big things that we can do is to make sure that the communities that technologies are designed for actually have a voice in research and design processes. So things like co-designed apps and co-designed websites with the communities that these technologies are designed to help support is really important. For a long time, technology research development and technology design was really led by technologists, you know, people who do this for a profession and are very, very excellent at it. But I think a lot of assumptions often get baked into those processes when they're done in a removed way. You know, they're kind of kept behind institutions and design spaces rather than being based on kind of meaningful long-term engagement with communities. So we are starting to see some positive shifts in this direction, where technology companies are recognizing the importance of actually talking to the people that they're trying to design technologies for, but we certainly need much more of that at a much greater scale.
Yeah, amazing. That was Dr. Ash Watson from the University of New South Wales speaking to The Wire. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakir, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.